every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. Ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise
high as the
For African peoples, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God-goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind, flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization, and they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us so we would never forget. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to our ancestors because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve, and at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to those ancestors because over time, they found themselves the object of a forced exodus. When they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diasporas, both objects of a global myopia that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to those ancestors because over time, they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that described them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to them because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists. the new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation. Ashe. Pour libation to those ancestors because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation. Those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation. Ashe. Pour libation to our children and those yet to be born. For they are the ones that you must teach. And you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity, for they will call your name in all eternity. To our children we pour libation. Ashe. Ashe. Asheo.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Broken glass everywhere. People on the stage, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise. Got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back. Junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far. Cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Standing on the front stoop, hanging out the window, watching all the cars go by, roaring as the breezes blow. Crazy lady living in a bag, eating out of garbage pails, used to be a fag hag. Such a dance to tango, skipped the life and dangle. A silk-on princess seemed to lost her senses. Down at the peep show, watching all the creeps, so she could tell her stories to the girls back home. She went to the city and got so did it. She had to get a pimp, she couldn't make it on her own. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. My brother's doing fast on my mother's TV. Says she watches too much, it's just not healthy. All my children in the daytime, Dallas at night. Can't even see the game or the Sugar Ray fight. The bill collectors, they ring my phone and scare my wife when I'm not home. Got a bum education, double-digit inflation. Can't take the train to the job, there's a strike at the station. Neon King Kong standing on my back, can't stop to turn around. Broke my sacroiliac, a mid-range migraine, cancer membrane. Sometimes I think I'm going insane, I swear I might hijack a plane. Don't push me, calm, I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. My son said, Daddy, I don't want to go to school because the teacher's a jerk. He must think I'm a fool. And all the kids smoke reefer. I think it'd be cheaper if I just got a job, learn to be a street sweeper. I dance to the beat, shuffle my feet, wear a shirt and tie, and run with the creeps because it's all about money. Ain't a damn thing funny. You got to have a con in this land of milk and honey. They push that girl in front of the train, took her to the doctor, sewed her arm on the game. Stabbed that man right in his heart. Gave him a transplant for a brand new start. I can't walk through the park cause it's crazy after dark. Keep my hand on my gun cause they got me on the run. I feel like an outlaw, broke my last glass jaw. Hear them say, you want some more? Living on a seesaw. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. Say what? It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder.
I love being black. I love being called black. I love being an American. I love being a black American. But as a black man in this country, I think it's a shame that every few years we get a change of name. Since those first ships arrived here from Africa that came across the sea, there were already black men in this country who were free. And as for those who came over on those terrible boats, they were called nigger and slave and told what to do and how to behave. And then Master started tripping, doing his midnight tipping, down to the slave shacks where he forced he and great-great-grandma to be together. And the great-great-grandpa protested, he got tarred and feathered. And at the same time, the black men in the country who were free were mating with the tribes like the Apache and the Cherokee. And as a result of all that, we're a parade of every shade. And in this late day and age, you can be sure there ain't too many of us in this country whose bloodline is pure. But according to a geological geographical genealogy study published in Time magazine, the black African people were the first on the scene. So for what it's worth, the black African people were the first on Earth, and through migration, our characteristics started to change and rearrange to adapt to whatever climate we migrated to. And that's how I became me, and you became you. So if we're going to go back, let's go all the way back. And if Adam was black and Eve was black, then that kind of makes it a natural fact that everybody in America is an African American. Everybody in Europe is an African European. Everybody in the Orient is an African Asian, and so on and so on. That is, if the origin of man is what we're going to go on. And if one drop of black blood makes you black like they say, then everybody's black anyway. So quit trying to change my identity. I'm already who I was meant to be. I'm a black American born and raised. And Brother James Brown wrote a wonderful phrase. Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. Because I'm proud to be black. And I ain't never lived in Africa. And because my great-great-granddaddy on my daddy's side did, don't mean I want to go back. Now, I have nothing against Africa. It's where some of the most beautiful places and people in the world are found. But I've been blessed to go a lot of places in this world. And if you ask me where I choose to live, I pick America, hands down. Now, by and by, we were called Negroes, and after a while that name was banished. Anyway, Negro is just how you say black in Spanish. Then we were called colored, but shit, everybody's one color or another, and I think it's a shame that we hold that against each other. And it seems like we reverted back to a time when being called black was an insult, even if it was another black man who said that a fight would result, because we've been so brainwashed that black was wrong till even the yellow niggas and the black niggas couldn't get along. But then came the 1960s. When we struggled and died to be called equal in black, and we walked with pride with our heads held high and our shoulders pushed back, and black was beautiful. But I guess that wasn't good enough, because now here they come with some other stuff. Who comes up with this shit anyway? Was it one or a group of niggas just sitting around one day? Feeling a little insecure again about being called black and decided that African-American sounded a little more exotic. Well, I think you were being a little more neurotic. It's that same mentality that got Amos and Andy put off the air because they were embarrassed about the way the character spoke. And as a result of that action, a lot of wonderful black actors ended up broke when we were just laughing and having fun about ourselves. So I say, fuck you if you can't take a joke. You didn't see the Beverly Hillbillies being protested by white folks. And if you think, that of course you think, that being called African American sets all black people's minds at ease, since we affectionately call each other nigger, I affectionately say to you, nigger, please. come I didn't get a chance to vote on who I'd like to be? Who gave you the right to make that decision for me? I ain't under your rule or in your dominion, and I'm entitled to my own opinion. Now, there are some African Americans here, but they recently moved here from places like Kenya, Ethiopia, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Zaire. But not a brother whose family's lived in this country for generations, occupying space in all the locations, New York, Miami, L.A., Detroit, Chicago, even if he's wearing a dashiki and sporting an afro. And if you go to Africa in search of your race, you'll find out quick you're not an African American. You're just a black American in Africa taking up space. Why you keep trying to attach yourself to a continent where even if you got the chance to go and you went, most people there wouldn't even claim you as one of them, as a purebred daughter or son of them. Your heritage is right here now, no matter what you call yourself or what you say. And a lot of people died to make it that way. And if you think America's the leader on inequality and suffering and grieving, how come there's so many people coming and so few leaving? Rather than all this fine thought with America shit you promoting, if you want to change something, use your privilege. Get to the polls. Come as a voting. God knows we've earned the right to be called American Americans and be free at last. And rather than you moving forward with progress, you're dwelling in the past. We struggled too long. We've come too far. And to the folks that know who we were, let's be proud of who we are. We're the only people whose name is always a trend. When is this shit going to end? Look at all the different colors of our skin. Black is not our color. It's our core. It's what we've been living and fighting and dying for. But if you choose to be called African American and that's your preference, then I give you that reference. But I know on this issue I don't stand alone on my own. And if I do, then let me be me. And I'd appreciate it if when you see me, you say, there goes a man who says it loud. I'm black. I'm black. I'm a black American and I'm proud because I love being an American. And I love being black. I love being called black. Yeah, I said it. And I don't take it back.
You are listening to Elders of Sankofa with host the Elders. The Elders of Sankofa radio broadcast is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, which operates on the timeforawakening.com radio platform. Reach out to them at Sankofa_think@out.com. All of our programs are archived. Just go to www.timeforawakening.com. Access the search portal and type in the name of the program you desire to review.
Welcome, 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 family. This is Brother Kwazi. We have a wonderful show for you tonight. I have one of my close friends, my brother Kwaku, Dr. Ramel Smith, and we're going to be talking about mental fitness. But first, again, I'd like to thank Dr. William Rogers, Dr. James, and Sister Dee Dee. We're going to have her give our ancestral profile. But first, let me tell you about our program tonight. The Sankofa Council and guests will inspire and celebrate the empowerment of the black male and female and child becoming confident, powerful, and great. Now we must know the truth that has been denied and replaced with lies of our, to our determinant and for the entitlement of our oppressors. So we're going to be focusing on mental fitness. And so at this time, I'm going to introduce Sister Dee Dee kindly with our ancestral profile. Sister Dee Dee.
Yes, good evening. Good evening, my brothers and sisters. I want to speak a little bit about Francis Press Welsing. I don't want to mess up her name. Lord have mercy. But anyway,
Welsing, yes. Mm-hmm.
Can you say that again for me?
Dr. Francis Kress Welsing.
Welsing. Okay. Thank you so much, brother. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anyway, Francis Kress Welsing, a psychiatrist, best known for her writing, The Isis Papers, was born Francis, I believe her last name, I'm going to spell it. Her middle name, Luella. And her last name was Kress, of course, Cress. She was born in Chicago, Illinois, on March 18th, 1935. Welsing who was the child of physician Henry Crest and teacher Ida May Griffin, grew up the middle of three daughters. She received her bachelor's in science from Antioch College in Ohio in 1957, and her medical degree from Washington, D.C., Howard University in 1962. After earning M.D., Wesley stayed in Washington, D.C., pursuing a career in child and general psychiatry. Wesley spent nearly 25 years working as a staff physician in D.C., in D.C.'s Department of Human Services, and also as the clinical director of two schools catering to children with emotional trouble. Wesley opened her own private practice in D.C. in 1967. Through her published work and her research, Wesley sought to help bring about a solution to the mental health of the Black community by understanding racism. Ooh-wee. I'm not going to go there. Okay. Wesley published her first major work. It was called The Crest Theory of Color Confrontation as an essay in 1974. While assistant professor at Howard University, Wesley argued that the drive for white supremacy and superiority stems from pervasive feeling of inadequacy and inferiority. Wesley claimed that whiteness was in fact a deficiency, evidenced by the inability of whites and other races to produce melanin, which generates the skin color. In short, white people in America could not cohabit peacefully with their Black peers, according to Wesley, because of a deep-seated jealousy of people with melanin and their embrace of racial supremacy. Oh, man. Wesley prevented her from not only gaining at Howard, but in fact losing her teaching post. In 1991, Wesley published her most famous work, a collection of essays titled The Isis Papers, The Keys to the Colors, which discuss in depth the issues of white supremacy and racism in the United States. The ISIS paper, Wesley, went deeply into her theories of melanin deficiencies among whites as the driver of racism, white supremacy, and white segregation. And it's unbelievable. Dr. Francis Crest Wesley died in Washington, D.C. on January 2nd, 2016, after being hospitalized for a stroke. She was 86 years old. I don't know, it's sad to say. You know, sometimes I wonder if when, I don't know, I'm not going to even go there, brother. But I'll just stop right there.
Okay. Well, thank you, Sister Dee Dee.
You're welcome. You're very welcome.
All right, people. Well, thank you very much for our ancestral profile. And we want to thank you again for listening to Dr. Will Rogers' Black Reality Think Tank. Our guest, Dr. Kwaku, are you with us?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. I'm going to let you give us a little bio on yourself, if you don't mind.
No, not at all.
Or yours.
It's a pleasure to be here with the Black Reality Think Tank once again. It's always a pleasure to be with it. As in the tradition of our elders, it's always customary to ask for permission from an elder, but since you gave me the floor, I will accept that as that invite. As you said, my name is Kwaku Atchafi Ramel Smith. Born Ramel Smith in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but after my Sankofa to Ghana, specifically to Cape Coast, where I was renamed Kwaku Atchafi. Kwaku meaning that son, that male child born on a Wednesday. Atchafi meaning he who is a lover of justice and one who connects people. I thought that name was so aptly applicable to me for the things that I do. Born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, matriculated through the school system in Wisconsin. I got my PhD from the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. And I don't say that so much with pride. I say that almost in the spirit of ancestor Carter G. Woodson in the miseducation of the Negro, because it was still this PhD program in which I was programmed in a very European indoctrinated very European philosophy of psychology, and it took some time to reverse that. And so even though I received the highest of educational honors, it actually put me behind in being a true benefit to my community. And it took a time, and it did. I did that specifically, unfortunately, through trial and error in the community. I worked in the Milwaukee public school system as a teacher and a school psychologist. I worked as a psychologist, a clinical psychologist within our correctional system and within the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. Since then, I started my own business, Blacksmith Psychological Consultative Services. It's been going strong since 2007. I'm happy to say that I've had contracts with big clients such as federal government, NBA teams, NFL teams, with Nike, Gillette, things of that nature. But I'm more proud of the contracts that I have within the city and within the school districts, specifically with young people who look like me, to be able to add in that station. I've been blessed to be able to write 3 books, been used on multiple platforms, but it's nothing like being at home with your own. And so when I get a chance to be able to come and to be able to hear the Black National Anthem, to be able to hear a libation, to be able to hear Dr. Francis Cress Wilson, who was a big influence on my life. Even before I walked into the field of psychology, I remember seeing her on Phil Donahue and just being blown away by her. But I'm married, have 5 children, and I love my people, and I want to make sure that when I leave here and take my place with the ancestors, that I make my creator and the elders proud.
Well, thank you. I so appreciate hearing all that. I know you worked at a group home for a short period of time.
And some of my contracts, I did some work with foster care system, specifically here in Milwaukee with Fresh Start, the only Black-owned foster care agency here in the state, from top to bottom, owned by a good friend of mine, Jermaine Reed. And with that being stated, I got a chance to be able to help with the social workers, a lot of the people who did the one-on-one work, to be able to more adequately leverage themselves in the community, to be able to have access to more resources, to more individuals, in addition to be able to ask some of those questions specifically for the staff that had less melanin, to be able to deal effectively with the clientele, our people who they were working with. But then also what I loved about it is inside of the group homes, I got a chance to work directly on the front lines with some of the young men who were going through very challenging and troublesome times being in the system.
Well, you know, I'm thinking, you know, everybody is going through some difficult times with the pandemic and with a lot of agencies that we reach out to, social service agencies, due to the pandemic, to the COVID situation, are not accessible. So there's been a rise in domestic violence, a rise in just a lot of issues, especially with people not being able to provide to their families because of job situations and scenarios where people have just
lost their way of making money, and then there's not a relief package for a lot of people. And so does that impact your work somewhat, or are you seeing some changes or some things that people are doing to just try to help? What's going on?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think whenever you look at the social determinants in life, these were issues that were much challenging to us before pandemic. So whenever you add any other type of adversity, any other type of trial, any type of calamity, it's going to exacerbate that situation. And so you speak about, you know, increases in domestic violence, in sexual assault, and homicides, all of those things that are a little bit more greener to the eye, 100%. But also what we see on the backside is we see an increase with the sexual assault, but with the molestation, we see an increase with the child abuse. We see an increase with the emotional abuse, those things that can't be registered on a scale but have invisible scars that last a long time, and those invisible scars are then manifested in a visible, usually network negative outwork. But also inside of that pandemic, what you see is an increase in self-medication. So you see it as it relates into drugs, whether they be legal or if they be illicit. You see an increase in more sexual behavior and gambling behavior, any of those kind of excessive behaviors that can somehow create high dopamine levels, excitement for the time period, but then at the end come down crashing. But also what you got to think about is the strain within the hospital system. So when we start to think about the small things as far as pregnancies, the attention given to those who are in the NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit, and when we look at our precious Black babies, we already see that we have a high rate of infant mortality, high rate of low birth weight, things of that nature. So when you think of what's going on with them for the longevity, we're looking at the consequences of a pandemic. So now you put all of those things in that was going on, and now we look at the pandemic. And yes, the quickest things we see is the domestic violence, the rushes in the family, all of those things. And then what happens when there's a death in the family, when there's CPS called in because there's no food, because there's different calamities within the house that they would consider undesirable conditions, or the children was taken out because of something dangerous. Now, that goes into the case you were talking about specifically with foster care. And what we see in there, it's already been a system that has been abused for so long. It's foster care, just like special education, has too long been a pipe line into the prison care system. And that's because so much of the care that's given is given in general. There's always some exceptions, but the rule is that you don't get exceptional care. You don't get those families to be put back together in a healthy type of manner. And you see the negative behavior. So you put all of that again inside of a pandemic. And now what we get is inside of these group homes, even more calamity. You see now a high rate when we talk about with COVID. Now, we saw that the disproportionality rate within our community, specifically the Black and brown communities, but we just focus on our community. You started to see, wow, well, what's going to happen? Because so many children is getting it. And they say, oh, well, children don't have any issues with it. They usually can get it, recover it, and go on. The thing is, nobody knows the lasting effects of what COVID is going to be. So we still haven't seen the true effects. You think about it like the coal miners in West Virginia. Everybody thought those were great jobs. But then when they started to get the Black Death, the lung cancer, things of that nature, they understood that, hey, you know what? This is a cluster that comes specifically from that. There's going to be some things that we're going to find out about COVID are going on. And I say that to say this, because we're starting to see some of those symptoms here. And that goes back into the increased domestic violence, the increased sexual assault, the increased suicides, the increased verbal and physically aggressive behavior that we're seeing inside of our people. Now, when you have that in a structure with people who are developing and they don't have that structure and they have all of these other calamities over the side of their head, we ask how our children doing. I work in the school systems regularly. This is both suburban, urban, from kindergarten to the 12th grade and even through post-secondary. And the one word that every student, not every student, but the majority of students that I work with is crumbling. They say they're crumbling. Now, some of these students come from what we would consider good homes, two-parent homes, where finances.
What was that word again you just said?
You said crumbling. crumbling, C-R-U-M-B-L-I-N-G. You think about a building crumbling down,
mm-hmm.
and it's a slow crumble. And when this is the word that's been used on many occasions, many times by people who haven't heard, that's why you look on the nightly news and there's a fight. The children, the parents want the children back into the schools. The teachers don't mind the children coming back to school. They just want it in a safe way. They don't want it to have to be in a place that's not contained, where they don't have whatever safety precautions they believe that they need to be able to operate in a safe environment. And when you start to see that, that's because the children are being isolated. The children can't. I hear working with adults that they have Zoom fatigue. And so it's no wonder that children, specifically with attention spans that they have via video games, via social media, things of that nature, that this would be a tremendous challenge for them. So you're going to see so many students not only have like a wasted year, you're going to see a regression of several years. You look up in the educational field, and this is specifically for our foster care, where we're really worried about like them missing, bouncing from school. When children have a bad year, not only do they not learn that year's material, they usually regress. And we're seeing that in larger numbers than ever. So even though people will be socially promoted this year, you got to wonder what level of material will they really be ready for when we do have some level of sense of normalcy. And who's going to be affected the most? Those specifically within the foster care system, without people to advocate for them, to be able to fight for them, to make sure that they have everything that they need in real time.
Well, you know, I have a question for you in regards to what do you think are you in that situation still where how people are being misdiagnosed and how they're being treated. And what I'm seeing, and I'm talking about people of color, you know, versus this guy is being treated and this mental sickness where it's a crime. In that kind of relationship. But before we go to that, I'm just going to take a moment to give thanks to our sponsor, eDoc Advice. It is a website created to provide a place to go to get answers to your health or medical concerns. Questions are answered by health professionals and to those who are knowledgeable about helping you make decisions about your personal health that make sense to you. And www.edocadvice.com. EDOC Advice, we do not replace your health professionals or provide your care, but we can help you become a better consumer so that you can get the best information to make a truly informed decision. We network with other health professionals throughout the country and bring that information to you. Okay, so very cool.
Your question was on the misdiagnosis. And the thing is, if you look back all the way from when, from a legislative standpoint, there's always been a slant. And you go back to the eugenics movements, but if you go back to where it's been done kind of in a more humane type of covert manner, you go to the American Disabilities Act, where Congress had to step in and say, hey, listen, our people with disabilities are not treated being equally. They need to have the same equal access as everyone else. Now, those disabilities went from physical disabilities to also mental disabilities. But what happened is people saw this as another way to do a Jim Crow, to do another way to segregate, to do another way to disenfranchise people. So specifically within the education realm, they passed a public law, 94-142, which then turned into IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And then that was even formed. That was in 1997, but then it was reauthorized in 2004 as IDEIA. And so with those fancy terms, those little acronyms, basically that was the footing for special education. And so from this time is when they started to misdiagnose. And why do you misdiagnose? Because 77% of the education field is by white women. And so now when you have a white woman who's college educated, who has a different level of a socioeconomic status, she has to what? Deal with a young black male. So now we're dealing with three different entities from demographics that they can't relate to. And that's gender, that's race, and that's an economic status. And so the ability for her to teach that guy is going to be, it's going to be very difficult. And so because her learning style, her teaching style, what she believes is good, is relevant, is not reaching this newer young man, guess what? Something must be wrong with him. And that's when they slide into special education. And that's why you see a disproportionate of black boys and black girls, specifically black boys, into special education classes. Now, when they're in these special educations, this is going on from Larry P. Versus state of California in 1970, 1972, lawsuits all the way up until today. They find different ways to put young black boys into stigmatizingly negative classes. And this is the case. Even when they're not put in special education, in special education classes, they're still given watered down curriculum. And this is the ironic part. Even if you go to schools where sometimes a parent will say, well, I want to take my child out of an urban school and put them in a suburban school, hoping they will get a better education. And in sacrifices of getting that better education, they get a different level of segregation. They get a different level of discrimination. So whenever you go into those schools, you still see routinely that these children may do better than the average child of color, black child specifically, maybe like within a central city school. However, their rate of attendance, their rate of suspension, their rate of detention for the few chocolate chips that they have in there are exorbitantly higher than what the others are, specifically the whites and Asians and even Latinos. So when you see that, what you see is that it's a natural bias. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Can I just ask a question?
Yes.
Yes.
Go ahead,
you know, as you're talking, and we know, you know, a lot of our children, their teachers are white. I want to know how and what can we do, or what is needed to do, because that needs to change. Our children need to see someone that looks like them, someone that's teaching them, someone that looks like them. You have two different cultures here, and to me, white folks just don't understand our children. They can hardly deal with their own. But our children, it's time that they start seeing someone that looks like us. And I feel, too, that the curriculum needs to be changed drastically. It's sad. The books that are in these schools, you don't have any books in these schools that are teaching our children anything about Madam CJ or anybody black. You know, even the three women that you know, back in the day that were working for the astronauts or whatever.
Right.
That didn't come out. You know, they just finally said they had to make a movie of that, you know, because little bits and pieces now are starting to come out. But my children need to be taught before this even comes out. And it just needs to be something done. You know, and if we have them at home, and for most of us, if we can teach them now while they are at home, then I feel we need to get busy. And there's a little part in one of Frances, in one of her books, you know, where it was saying all black children before the age of six should be taught the following fundamental exercises in black self-respect by black adults, example, in homes, schools, churches, and neighborhoods. They need to learn how to stop calling one another names. Learn, you know, stop cursing at one another. Stop squabbling. Stop gossiping. You know, and then it also says, you know, that stop being so disrespectful, robbing one another. Stop stealing from one another, fighting, killing, and then stop using and selling drugs to one another. Stop throwing trash and dirt in the streets and places where we as black people have to live. Just try to learn. I mean, they need to be taught self-respect of who they are themselves.
Sure.
And they're going to, and they should be seeing that from us.
Well, you know, Sister Dede, that brings me
and
to...
Thanks for letting you get that out, gentlemen.
Oh, no, I appreciate your comment. But, you know, it just brings me to a quote that I was thinking about earlier from Marcus Garvey. And his one of his quotes is, if you have no confidence in self, you are twice defeated in the race of life. And so when I think about that comment and I think about what we're learning, and the comment that you made, Kwaku, in regards to how you learned from the European standpoint, and it threw you, and you had to educate yourself by other means, but you had to go through this system, and you got your accolades, and you know, you've done the work. But what is it that we can do? Because we're certainly not being taught or given the information or the truth about the greatness that we have, the things that we've done throughout the beginning of time. You know, when we think about Napoleon having the pyramid, blowing the noses and the lips off of the pyramids and so forth, so that people, so they didn't look black, you know. They know the greatness of us from beginning, and just the writings on the wall, all that information, and it's just
right.
Been so just kept from us, and it's just not in the schools, and we just have to take over those situations and teach our people. I mean, so we got to get to a point where we're not trying to integrate, where we just, you know, have our own schools. And I think that that's a direction that we should go.
But see, that's a very complicated, it's a very complicated question, because we say, well, what do we do? Because the truth of the matter is, we can say theoretically what we need to do, what we want to do, but is it practical? Like tomorrow, we're not going to have an all-black school, even though
right.
I wish we would for all of our children. But I'm not saying we can't reach towards that point, and that's something we have to do. So what I'll do is I'll try to address it in three quick points. The first thing, what we have to do is we have to educate these white people on how to teach us. So that means the parents have to become more proactive in the students' education. They have to become more proactive in the things we did. And the reason why this is so difficult is because we have to remember that at the base of everything is always going to be the root of white supremacy. And the reason why we have a lot of dysfunction that we have now is based on all of those things, the economic disadvantages that we have, the proximity control that they're putting up on us with the harassing of the police, things of that nature. So when you put a system into place, everything is worked and set up for us to be almost self-destructive. And so you say, well, how do we do that? Only because we are so resilient, only because of the power of our ancestors have we been able to do the things that we did into a land in which we were stolen. And so when we say that, so what we have to do is, for those of us who are relatively conscious, who are relatively understanding of this, is we have to bring pressure to bear upon those school systems, upon those powers to be, to say, hey, this is what we want in the schools. This is what we need in the schools. Again, we go back to Carter G. Woodson. He said, because they are not talking about the accolades, not only of our great ancestors from Africa, but those contributions that have been done here in these United States of America, he said, I'm going to create Unite Negro Achievement Week, which has now bloomed into Black History Month. But what he said, this will be a time to what articulate all of the great things that we have done as a country, as we contributed to society. And we know for a fact that if not for our people, America would not be where America is right now, even today. So you say we have to then bring pressure upon these white educators, the systems that promote the learning, the education, as far as the pre-service places, as far as those when they're there, when they have to get continuing education services. But now this is the big one, because this is where we can really...
Hello?
Sorry about that. I pressed the mute on my phone.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Where did I cut off at?
I think you said you just paused for a second, and so I just kind of missed where you were.
No, I said the second thing, what we have to do is with our black teachers that are in our black educators, because we have a multitude, even though they're still not a lot, not nearly enough. There is enough. Just one black person in the school, just one black person in the school district can create enough havoc to make people feel uncomfortable by your very presence. Now, it can't just be your presence, because we say we can have a black face in a high place, but if that black face does not do the things but only maintains the status quo, well, then that person is no more valuable than any of those other white teachers who's doing damaging to us. So what we cannot confuse is just the face and the melanin and the skin. It's just been a miseducation of the mind. But when there is a true knowledge of self, a true love of self, then that's when you say, what are those things that those teachers are willing to do? How can we then gel ourselves together? And then what we have to do is to the point and where we say, well, where can we go? Because those things say, hey, these are embedded within the system. When you look at the work of Elijah Muhammad from the Nation of Islam, he stated that the first teacher is the mother. And so when you start to think about what happens in the home, being able to create that self-love, you look at somebody like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, it's so backwards to me, because he talks about, you know, the basic things that people need. And it's a theory. So it can be disputed, and I dispute his theory specifically for our people, because if you look at the bottom of this theory, he talks about you need food and water and warmth. I said, what we need is we need love and we need attachment. We're a culture that's built on collectivism. So when you start to see the true village, the true responsible village, the true love, that's where the education go. Even if you go into to those who are esteemed within the world of trauma, the white psychologist, the white psychiatrist, somebody like a Dr. Bruce Perry, he says the basic things that young children need is love and attachment. He said, well, our society standards are so backwards. We're always trying to rush these children into doing things before they have the love. And so we talk about foster care. Guess what? Even if your parents are not there for you traditionally, if you have a true village system, no child ever gets lost. One thing George Bush said that I agree with, he said, no child left behind. I just didn't agree with how he wanted to implement it or who he wanted to implement to, because they were really talking about white children. It sounded good, but they had no real thing behind it. But if we do that, now we say, how do we create our own HBCUs before we get to college? How do we create those within the nursery care where it's not just by loving people who can give them love, but then who can also supplement that with a true education, a knowledge of self? Then after you do that, how do we get that? I look at the grade school I grew up in, and I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, on 7th and Melvina, which was a low SES neighborhood. But you know what we had? We had all black teachers. I remember learning. I heard the national anthem. I knew the black national anthem before I knew the American national anthem. And I knew it before the second grade. You know why? Right. Because Miss Jones taught us. We never had the words. She just sang it to us all the time till we knew it. And so what it was putting pride. But guess what else I saw in my house? I saw ebony. I saw jet. I saw essence. These were things that gave me a black pride. So when I did start to go to more culturally diverse schools, already had a knowledge and love of myself. And so when some of the nonsense came, I had some of the protection to be able to know who I was and not get lost in their identity. The thing was, is I was just still indoctrinated inside of that curriculum that was heavy European, very Eurocentric, dominated. So what we have to do is recognize, and specifically at this time, as Sister Dee Dee said, we have to do things in our own home. We've always been told you got to be twice as good to get half as far. So if this is the time, we understand that. What are the things that we're doing at home to supplement the education that they're getting in the schools, to counteract the education they're getting in the schools, to challenge, but also to help inform the educators? When I go to school with my children, and I know how I advocate for them, I know they get a different education, and their other students benefit from the education because of my children, because of the pressure we put on those teachers. We don't come in there with guns blazing. We come in there with an academic pedigree. That stuff does work, as you stated before, Dr. Kwasi, it does work. You know, so it does have some purpose and utility. But at the end of the day, it's not just the title. It's what we bring, and we bring curriculum. We bring suggestions. We bring ideals that make sense if they really want to be about it. But also inside of my work, I make sure that I don't just work in inner city schools. I make sure I work with the suburban schools for them to hear stuff that's going to make them feel uncomfortable, that's going to push them, that's going to pressure them to be able to look at things differently, to see things that, just to be honest, they don't have to see, because they live in a world where they've been fortunate in white supremacy and white privilege to not even understand some of the things that's going on. So what I have to do is to take off the blinders, make them feel uncomfortable, but still give them a level of security and implement that, and seeing how in educating all children, it helps everybody. Now, this is the thing. Some people don't want that because they want the status quo to remain. And then, you know, you said a quote, And one of my favorite quotes is from Frederick Douglass. And he says, if there's no struggle, there's no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet depreciate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the roar of its muddy, muddy right. waters. He said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did and it never will. Find out just what people will submit to. You have found the exact amount of injustice and wrong which will be imposed upon them. And these will continue until they are resisted with either words or blows or with both. The limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they oppress. And what that means in a nutshell is your tyrants, your oppressors will do what you let them do. We are outraged at what happened on January 6th at the state capitol. And we know what would have happened with black people if they would have stormed right. the capitol like that. But the thing is this. They do to us because we let them do. We let them beat us up. We let them kill us without any type of consequences. We let them miseducate us without consequences. We let them misdiagnose us. We let them maltreat us from a medical standpoint without any consequences. And until we are bold enough, brave enough, even willing to give our very lives for it, this is going to continue. So we say, what do we have to do? We have to be strong enough to demand to say, if you don't do it, we will. And with the tax dollars we pay, we're going to force you. We're going to demand upon you the things. We look at somebody like President Biden, who's in now, who got in specifically because of the black vote. Now, if we don't put the pressure up on him to bring in specifically changes to the community, to the education system, to the medical system, to the military system, all of the ways, the correctional system, all of these industrial complexes that have ruined our community, if we don't get some other type of reparations, whether they be informal or informal matters, then shame on us, because the only reason things happen is because we let them. We are too passive and loving as a people, but we have to get to the point where we say enough is enough. And when you look at the spirit of those in the civil rights era, we need to regain that spirit.
Well, I think one of the things that's going on is probably the same thing when Obama became president. People sat back. They figured they got a black president. The Democrats are in. But we didn't make a lot of progress. And they made sure they didn't do anything that he said do. And that was one of the things that they prided themselves on for those 8 years. And so now we're kind of in that same situation, I feel, with Kamala Harris and Joe Biden. And
this is the thing. This is the one thing that now they understand. They have control of the Senate. They have control of the House. They have control of the legislative and the executive
branch. Yeah, she's that tiny vote, man.
Yeah, the judicial. I'm not sure about this. So, well, this is the thing. I'll say this. If Biden wants to push things through and he wants to go hard because he knows he's not going to get any support from the other side, then let's go. But let's not be naive and think that the Democrats are a friend of black people either. You know, they use and abuse us just as much right. as the Republican Party, just in a more covert manner. But with that being stated, I love Barack Obama for what he represented. I love seeing his beautiful wife, those beautiful black babies in the White House, and the sign of privilege. But to your point, he was raised by a white grandmother. And that doesn't make him any less black, because he's mixed and he was black, so he's black. I'm not questioning his blackness, but what I am questioning is his ability.
And no controversies for his age struggle.
When you look at Kamala Harris, even, you know, mostly raised by her Asian mother, and even though she went to a HBCU and all of these things, even the fact in which how she married a white man. Now, let Obama would have married a white woman and see how the talk would have been. You just see that there's some different lapses within that whole thing. And I'm not saying she can't love that man, but what I'm saying is the fact that she doesn't have a brother is a crack to me, is a crack of saying of what's important to her, because they said you can't talk black and sleep white. I believe it's a little creepy.
If she would have married a brother, she wouldn't be sitting in there where she at now.
But that's why she was the beautiful pick, because what? She was half black. Yeah. She was half Asian. She did have a white.
Well, Brother Quay Cool, Sister Didi, we are getting to the top of the hour. And so when we come back, we're going to open the lines for questions and comments. And so when we open the lines, the Black Reality Think Tank. You can call at 215-490-9832. That is 215-490-9832. All right. We'll see you when we return from the break.
When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back on insufficient
funds. I'm always ready for a war again. Go down that road again. It's all the same.
Fight you, I fight myself, I fight God, just tell me how many burdens left. I fight pain and hurricanes, today I wept. I'm trying to fight back tears, flood on my doorsteps. Life and living hell, puddles of blood in the street. Shooters on top of the building, government aid ain't relief. Earthquake, the body drop, the ground breaks. The poor run with smoke lungs and scarred face. Who need a hero?
Hero.
You need a hero, look in the mirror, there go your hero. Who on the front lines at ground zero?
Hero.
My heart don't skip a beat even when hard times bumps the needle. Mass destruction and mass corruption, the souls of suffering men. Clutching on deaf ears again, rapture's coming. It's all prophecy, and if I gotta be sacrificed for the greater good, then that's what it gotta be.
Time for an awakening media lineup. Monday,
11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives, with host Brother Oshi, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Same time, same place. Continued Monday lineup, 6 p.m. till 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds, with host Brother Jihad Ahmed, 8 p.m. till 9 p.m., Black Therapy Central, host Dr. Mawia Kambom and Sister Nataki Kambom, 9 p.m. till 10 p.m., Conversation Reparations, first and third Mondays. On Tuesday, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Black Reality Think Tank, with host Dr. William Rogers. On Thursday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Melanin Live, with host Lance Jones, co-host Boniswa Ayan. Fridays, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Time for an Awakening, with creator of Time for an Awakening and host, Brother Elliot, co-hosted by Brother Richard. Saturday, 4 p.m. till 6 p.m., Black Sister Talk, with host Wanda Chambers. 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., The Elders of Sankofa. And Sunday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Time for an Awakening, host Brother Elliot and co-host Brother Richard. Check us out, get informed.
You are listening to Elders of Sankofa with host The Elders. The Elders of Sankofa radio broadcast is an affiliate of the Black Reality Think Tank, which operates on the timeforawakening.com radio platform. Reach out to them at Sankofa_think@outlook.com. All of our programs are archived. Just go to www.timeforawakening.com. Access the search portal and type in the name of the program you desire to review.
All right, all right. We are back. We are back on the Black Reality Think Tank. We're going to open our line for questions or comments. We have Kwaku, Dr. Ramel Smith, talking about mental fitness and how we are dealing with that. So the line is open, 215-490-9832. Brother Kwaku, how you doing?
Yes, sir. I'm doing good. Ready. Usually not just hyped up on a Saturday night. We usually wind it down in the household, watching a movie or something like that, from a family time. So to be able to have this conversation with the family is inspirational, inspiring, and encouraging to know that there's so many more like-minded people that knows that as far as we come in this country, still so much further to go, and to know you're fighting a war with so many other soldiers that you don't even know, just hearing it is inspirational and powerful, because we know that once we really unite and collectively bring our intelligentsia together, that something great can be done.
Well, I want to thank you again for this book, the Egyptian Book of the Dead. I can't wait to read that. I heard Doc Rogers, he was on the show in Atlanta, and just revealing so much of our truth and just knowing our history, what a change and empowerment that gives us, knowing the greatness in which we all started from, and we are the original. And that is just so empowering, just knowing those things. But again, our information that we are receiving or that we're getting is not the truth. And I guess one of the things that you had kind of mentioned earlier when you talked about going to school and as a psychiatrist, and the people that they had you read, their theories and their thoughts with Marx and people, I mean, how has that changed you, or what benefit was that to you?
Well, you know what? So my favorite rapper of all time is KRS-One. And the reason why I love him is because when you listen to a lot of his lyrics, he will read out of the Book of the Dead. He will talk about the importance of love of self. And see, I grew up in the hip-hop generation right when it was on the cusp, and I was happy because I got a chance to see the X-Clan. I got a chance to listen to KRS-One. I got a chance to listen to Public Enemy. I got a chance to listen to Arrested Development when I was still in that naive and developmental stage. So the things I was hearing was things that was encouraging and inspiring to my spirit. And so in listening to that, it made me think about it, because even in KRS-One song, he had a song. He was talking about you must learn, and he was talking about they never taught me these things in school. So when I learned about Freud, when I learned about Piaget, when I learned about Anna Freud, when I started to learn about Eric Erickson, when I started to learn about all of these other different people, even the philosophers, you know, you go into that philosophy thing where you learn about Socrates, Aristotle, and Plato, and Rene Descartes, and Friedrich Nietzsche, all of those things. You say, well, who are our people? And so I started to learn about the Francis Crest Wilsons. I learned about the Amos Wilsons. I learned about the Bobby Wrights. I learned about the Jawans, the Kinjufus, the Naeem, Akbars, people of that nature. And so when you start to go into this right here, now you start to say, hey, guess what? There's so many different people on so many different levels in which I need to go into. And so when it was time for me to do a report, I would go into the Journal of Black Psychology. And the reason why the Journal of Black Psychology was created was because they understood that psychology was so limited. And so we have a big division called the American Psychological Association, ABPSA, which is American Black Psychologists. They said, you know what, we need to leave because they're not doing anything for us. This is actually detrimental. And the irony is they had Martin Luther King come in to speak to the APA in 1967. And he said, hey, you are the helpers. You are supposed to be the people who are supposed to be healing this. You can't be part of the problem.
Could you go back a second? You said the Journal of Black Psychiatry. There's a book that we can go to?
Well, see, the Journal of Black Psychology is a periodical, so it's about study. So every quarter, there's journal articles that's presented with people who are doing studies, but the Journal of Black Psychology is just like the Ebony or the Essence, where Ebony and Essence is to Time and Life magazine, things of that nature. The Journal of Black Psychology was to the Journal of Psychology, the Journal of Abnormal Psychology, that always looked at black as some type of pathology or even ignored, one of the two. And so the Journal of Black Psychology was a way to have positive psychology that looked at us, to look at our strengths, to look at the things that we were doing, the things that were great, to get the articles that would not be presented or approved of in some of the other periodicals and whatnot that was dominated by Europeans and things of that nature. And even today, when you look at so many of the people who are accepted into certain affiliations, it's because they will still, from a meritorious man you mentioned, you look at the work of Dr. Claude Anderson. I think he's been one of the ones from this century that talks about that law that was passed in Virginia in 1710 that allowed blacks to then somehow either gain their freedom, and it was either by supporting the master, betraying the people that looked like them, things of that nature. And so with that being said specifically, the Journal of Black Psychology opened up a different world for me to let me know, wow, with so many different things. We talk about like the misdiagnosis. Well, we know that the Wechsler Intelligence Series, we know the Stanford-Binet, we know Woodcock-Johnson, all of those things normed heavily on white people. There was a man by the name of Dr. Robert Williams, who was one of the presidents of ABPSA. He created a different measure. It was called the BITCH, and it was an acronym. It was called the Black Intelligence Test of Cultural Homogeneity. And in this test, what he did is he made a test that was so black that when anybody who was white tried to take it, they failed. And he said, this is the same thing that's happening with our children. He said, you're testing them on stuff that they have no knowledge on, that's not taught to them properly. But when you give us something that we know, look at what we do. And so the people talked about the reliability and the validity of his test and tried to bring it down. He said, hey, you can do that because it's true. He said, I brought this test to make a point. Yeah, he said you can take it on face validity. And he said, what it is just saying you're testing people on things that they don't know. And you're using that as the measure where you're not looking at their true levels of intelligence to see how they are smart. And Sister Dee Dee talked about it before when she talked about Katherine Johnson and the other sisters from Hidden Figures. The reason why America got beat to the moon by Russia, the reason why America is not doing all that she can, is because she so oftentimes puts down her greatest people. When you look at people like W.E.B. Du Bois, when you look at people like Ernest Everjust, like Charles Drew, these great scientists from times of antiquity that have been put in different back rooms or being forced to go out of the country because they could not have a full education, full access to everything. We look at the great things that the Tuskegee Airmen did when they got great planes, when they got a chance to really do things. They shined above their peers, but look at what they had to go through to get that. Just imagine if they would have had the same equal treatment from the beginning. And because America is so scared, and you know how America, we know America is scared. It goes back to post-slavery. When you look at the first Reconstruction period, Emancipation Proclamation comes in 1865, where and we know our people weren't slaves. I don't even like using that word, but the enslavement period was over. We saw, and even though through convict leasing and some of the other ways, sharecropping to be able to keep so many black people down, the man I mentioned before, Carter G. Woodson, he was born in 1875, 10 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. Both his parents were born into slavery, didn't know how to read, but they were brilliant in what they did. And you know what they saw? That their son would go on to not only get a high school diploma, to not only get a bachelor's degree, but also get a doctorate degree, and to go on to be a great researcher and historian, educator. So you think about this, 10 years outside of slavery, he was able to do that. And the people got scared. And that's when Plessy versus Ferguson came in 1899, because they said, we got to separate them. We got to be able to say separate but equal, knowing it would be unequal and unlawful, and we would do different things to be able to keep this people down because they were so brilliant. They were so powerful. So those things that we see from there, we still see trickle down into society today, is looking for ways to put obstacles in our path so we can't be our greatest.
Hello? Excuse me again. Do we have any callers? I mean, do we have any listeners on the line that may want to, you know, ask some questions?
We have 225-288.
Yes. Yes.
Well, hello? Go ahead. Yeah, doctor, it's pretty interesting. There's a couple of questions. One, you said that we should educate whites, and because of the fact that we can't expect to immediately be able to educate our own children. And I'm wondering, in this kind of climate of white supremacy, what would kind of arguments would you use to motivate whites to even listen to us? There are a couple other points I'd like to make. You said that you had three moves on your agenda. One was educate whites, but you never did get to the other two. The third is that, I'm curious about what you think about Amanda Gorman's poem in terms of being able to advance the black agenda. And then the final thing is that Susan Rice is the domestic policy counsel for Joe Biden. And she made a speech the other day and made the point that white supremacy cost America about $20 trillion in GDP over the past, I believe, 20 years or it might have been 30 years. And she said that changing white supremacy would redound to a $5 trillion increase in GDP. So rather than the kind of moral arguments that basically say don't dog black people out because it's wrong, evidently they're talking about advancing some arguments and some other dimensions, and I thought that might be something. And then the final thing, and by the way, you can talk to any one of these that you want. I'm just giving you a lot of different licks. You said that you disagreed with Maslow's hierarchy model, and you suggested that, you know, obviously love was important. But I'm wondering if the black, I guess it's the American black, what is it, ABCI? Is that the name that you got?
Yes, sir.
What is their alternative model? And then finally, if you can put a number on there where I can send you something, I can send you some things. And by the way, I'm from your area. You I don't know if you know Marlon Taylor or Mark Taylor. You say you lived on 7th and Melvina?
Yes, sir. Born and raised.
Right. Do you know them? They lived on 4th and Avert. and
no,
their
no,
aunt,
that was right across from Port Washington. No, I don't.
Right, right,
know
and,
that,
and their aunt right. lived on 7th and Melvina, right, you know, right there on the corner. I think her name was Flowers.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I,
yeah,
I don't,
yeah,
I don't want to go too far into that.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so no, I can address all of those. I can address all of those. So the
oh yeah, yeah.
Said,
I'm sure I'm impressed with what I'm hearing. Go ahead.
So no, and I appreciate that because I think that's the beauty of our cultures. We're not a monolithic people, and I think we have to push each other in what we say. The first thing you said was, I said I was going to come with three, and I did say three. I fear that maybe when I was on mute, we didn't hear. But the first thing I said is we have to educate the white people. And to your point, I can kind of address this one here. There are some white people who, if you get from a moral standpoint, you're gonna move the needle some. Then there's some who's going to, because of the GDP, what Susan Rice talked about, if it shows their bottom line, they'll do it. But we also have to remember it's going to be a sect of white people who don't care. In fact, they will take the $20 trillion loss to keep white supremacy.
Right.
And I think President Johnson talked about that. He said, if you can make the lowest white man think he's better than the best black man, he won't let you just let you pick his pocket. He said, he'll give you the money. So we understand that. So when we say that, we do have to educate because we can't stop because that's what we're in. Now, the second thing we have to do is we have to get more black teachers and we have to really educate them to be culturally conscious in their curriculum. It has to be an African-centered conscious curriculum. It has to be something to give us a self-love, a self-knowledge, and a self-appreciation in all of the things what we can do that could build us up. And then the third thing, as I said, we have to teach ourselves. We have to have our own schools coming up from not just HBCUs, but all the way from the homes with the mother being the first teacher, then to grade schools and middle schools, all the way to post-secondary, that is very focused on us, for us, by us. So as we talk about that, two, Amanda Gorman, I loved her, but this is the honest truth. I promise you I can go to every school in America and find five Amanda Gormans. And that's no disrespect to that young queen because she was powerful. That's what happens when you put black excellence in the type of spotlight what she got. They was like, oh, wow, she could do this. But what happened to happen? She had to go to Harvard, and she was, you know, got all of these other credentials that made her put there. I can get you a poet from any school in any
city. Let me speak directly to two licks that Amanda Gorman hit that I think might be relevant. She comes out the gate saying that America isn't broken. America's unfinished. That's a lick that anybody's trying to advance the black agenda can use. She ends her poem with another lick saying that there's a whole lot of darkness, but if you have courage, you can see the light and you can be the light. So I'm not talking about her intellectual virtuosity. I'm talking about what she actually said. She put on the agenda an alternative paradigm. All of the so-called neoliberals and moderates and whatnot,
right.
You know, are clasping their pearls about how America is broken. And she said, "Well, no, it ain't broken. It never has been a democracy." And I'm thinking that can be an engine that can be used to advance a critique. But
I understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I thought the poem was brilliant, and I think you can go in two lanes with that. If you want to try to fix America, you want to try to repair America, you want to try to make America live up to its founding fathers, to the principles in which they stated to create a more perfect union and towards that, then that sounds beautiful. But if I'm being absolutely honest and I'm speaking from my heart and I'm telling you the truth, America is so broken that it cannot be fixed. America is working the way it wants to do.
Wait. She said it's not broken. Secondly, she said she even gave a critique of Martin Luther King when she said, hold it, it ain't about the content of our character. You notice the model that she had where she talked about character, she talked about color, she talked about culture, she talked about condition. In other words, the standard of whether or not we're a good society is not based upon the extent to which we imitate white people. That's called black respectability politics, and the limit of that is what Barack Obama did, and we see how far you can get with that. What we have to do is we have to advance the Wakanda model that basically says, there's an alternative to the white way of being in the world, and so on. And I'm saying, I'm just wondering. In other words, I don't want you to just dismiss her because she went to Harvard, because I don't like that either. But nevertheless,
I didn't dismiss her because she went to Harvard.
I think people think that she was able to get that.
I'm saying she was able to get the title of junior poet laureate because of those credentials that she had that the white people could respect to be able to see her and to hear her. So that's the only thing I was saying about that.
No. See the problem with Harvard for me is that, in fact, I met some people in Milwaukee that wanted to go to King. They were going to North, and they wanted to go to King. And I asked them why. They said, well, because it's a college prep school. I said, you can get prepared for college at North. But what will happen is that if they go to college and succeed, everybody will attribute their success to King. Similarly, people will attribute her success to Harvard, as opposed to the fact that she actually had that ability. That's what got her into Harvard, you know, and so on.
I 100% agree, because I went to Rufus King, so I know what you said. It was like it wasn't the school itself. It was something that was already within her. What I'm saying is, as much as I love the young sister, I fundamentally disagree with her. I don't believe America can be broken. And when you say advance or Wakanda.
No. She said America was not broken. She said America's unfinished. And she said the goal of America is not perfection. The goal of America is purpose, right? In other words, she had a fundamental critique of Plato, Aristotle, Cicero, Hobbes. I mean, you name them. She essentially deconstructed the whole Western idea. I'm saying that this wasn't, you know, just some intellectual virtuosity, just her ability to rap. I mean, she was actually saying something. She was hitting some licks, you know, and she was doing it on a world stage.
You will not get an argument from me that she is not brilliant, that her poem did not have many layers. What you will get from me is this. I believe America is what it is. And what she gave America was too much credit. And I believe that could be attributed to her beautiful youthfulness and naivete. And so what I say is this. When you look at prior to the Civil Rights Movement, where you see separate but unequal, but you saw these beautiful black communities, go back to the Tulsas, go back to all of the other brilliant, beautiful black towns when they were on their own, what happened? Now, you think if we did that again, you go to some of the teachings of Elijah Muhammad where he said, hey, separate. Martin Luther King Jr. said, I fear I've integrated my people into a burning building. America is deceitful and evil from the beginning. And if you plant evil seeds, you cannot get anything but evil fruits and plants to come up from it. We need to separate from this, because if you try to put good money after bad money, it all goes the way. So what I say is this, when I say we got to teach the white people, that's because we stuck up in it. But if we going to be bold and we going to do really what we going to do, we say give us liberty, give us death, give us separation or move us around. Because until we have our own sovereignty, until we have our own way of life, they still look at us as the descendants of slaves, and they will never give us the same type of respect.
Right.
You see it in the courtrooms. You see it in the prison. You see it in every structure built within America.
But, brother, you're actually talking the same thing. In other words, if I honestly and sincerely want to give you respect, then that means, let's say I'm your father. If I honestly and sincerely want you to be a man, then I want you to have your own house. I want you to have everything I got. And the only reason that you won't have your own house.
My real father don't want me to move out. What he want me to do is to be constructive to the land that we have and live together. See,
American idea.
That's not from a collectivist community. If my son want to stay with me for the rest of his life, but he adds and contributes to this household in a beautiful way, and we build upon the land where all of our land is together. Oh, well, then that's the beauty of it. That's what we want.
Your father wants you to be everything that he is, and you can't be everything that he is underneath him.
I'm just going to interrupt for a minute, just because this is a great conversation.
I love this dialogue. We do have some other callers.
And we want to
this is the beauty of black culture.
Dr. James, any more callers? Thank you, sir. Thank you all very much.
334.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. And
good evening. Good evening.
I just cannot, there's nothing that I can add to this. I would love to yield back to Brother Kwaku and Brother Pugh to continue this conversation, because there are things that I think that we all can learn from this. And yes, it's just interesting that the kind and type of dialogue that they're having, I can only sit at the feet of the elders and listen and learn. So I'm gonna yield.
Okay. I appreciate that.
998-919-998.
Caller, questions or comments?
414-587-417-587.
Caller, question or comments?
I just joined recently, and I'm enjoying the conversation.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
414-758.
All right. Caller, questions or comments?
Yeah, this is me, Charles Robinson. Man, that's a great conversation. And and with the two brothers who just had the dialogue, I love them both. Brother Smith and Brother Pugh, two of my people who I really look up to. I just called in to acknowledge what a wonderful conversation this was. That's all. Thank you.
Oh, no, I think you called for something else. I think you were telling me about a book.
Oh, The Healing Wisdom of Africa. The Healing Wisdom of Africa by Maladoma Somei is a book that I hope Dr. Smith has read, because we would have discussed that. The last time I saw him, he said he hadn't read it, so I'm going to get my shot.
I was blessed with that book by a beautiful elder in the community. So, yes, I have started to delve inside of that, in which I think has given me a more progressive look and looking about how do we create our own. How do we create our own beautiful Africa inside of here? I took to that point. A little exception with Smokey Robinson's poem in the beginning.
Right.
How he talked about America, but there's that distant connect that if I go back to Africa, they don't look at me the same. They don't see me. And you know the reason why that is? Because there's some part truth to that. Being able to go to Africa on multiple occasions, to different regions, and what it is when they look at you, they want to see, do you more assimilate with the American ideal, which is more Eurocentric, which is more that white man way of life? Or do you really want to do a Sankofa and come back home and be reacclimated, be refitted inside of that? But you also have to remember this, that in Africa, specifically within West Africa, that they've been colonized too. So they had the British there. They had the Portuguese. They had all of these different things. So in some mindset, they have some frustration too, even though they still get to plant their feet on the mother's land soil. So when we start to think about all of these things, my whole thing is, how do I never lose touch with Africa? Yes, I am a Black American. I live here. My citizenship is here. But my heart and my true citizenship will always be in Mother Africa. Now, the fact that I do not know exactly from where I'm at is one of the reasons why I stay consistently mad, and I think that goes into Baldwin, to be relatively conscious and to be African is to be in a rage all of the time. You know why? Because they stole something from me that I can't get back. You can steal a TV, you can steal a radio, you can steal a car, I could get a new one, or I could find the one I got, but I will never know my name. I will never know the place. And those are the things that you can't get back, and why you stay in a rage, why you stay frustrated. But when you go back, guess what? The ancestors have a way of guiding you in a different way, where you start to pick up information. And the beautiful thing about when I was in Ghana, and when I was adopted into the village, I was like, listen, I don't want this to just to be, kind of for show. I don't want this to be like, hey, I got a certificate and this is this. He said, no. Listen here. He said, in Africa, yes, there was slavery, but it was much different. It was nowhere cruel like it was in America. He said, because if you came into our village, whether it's through slavery, whether you were lost, whether it's through a debt or whatever or not, once you were acclimated into the village and adopted, you are ours. And we understand adoption here in America. And you tell a person who adopted a child that child is not theirs, you might get hurt. And so what the chief told me is, he said, listen, once you ours, you ours. And the reason why the name Atrophy means so much to me is because Kwaku is a day name. That's the name that's given to all that gives you that youth, that touch. But Atrophy was actually from an elder in the village. Mm-hmm. You think about how you feel
Horace Craft Jr., knowing where your name came from, or that it came from your uncle, that it came from an aunt, that it came from your grandmother, that it came from your mother, that's a thing that connects you in a different way. And so if you want that connective tissue, you want that cellular DNA to reawaken, oh, it can be awakened. It can be brought to you. And so what we have to do, what is our ability, and I think which will cause, you talk about mental fitness, which will allow us to really to be able to exercise that, to be able to maximize our potential, is to truly know who we are and to truly love who we are. As a psychologist, I work with many people who are adopted, and they can love that adopted family. And it's no discredit to the adopted family, but at some point in time, they say, I wonder who my biological mother is. I wonder who my biological father is. And even when they meet them, that doesn't mean they love that adopted parent anymore, less appreciate what was done or feel the connection. But it's something about knowing exactly where you came from that you have to know. And once you put in your mind, I don't need to know this, I don't have to do this, you can live with it as a point of closure. But there's always going to be at that point of closure you get where you're going to have to be satisfied with saying, this is something I never know, and I'm okay with it. But if
we were hoping so much to get Brother Jermaine Reed to call or be on here because he, you guys were together in Africa on one of your occasions, right?
Yes, sir. Brother Reed, a family emergency. I talked to him earlier today. He wanted to come, but he's in a family issue that needed his utmost importance. And so he said he wanted to come, but it was going to be very difficult. I told him, hey, focus on the family. So I doubt if he called, but I know for sure he had a family issue to come up.
Yeah, because he is just one that does so much for the community, and especially looking after our young and trying to get these families connected and staying together. And he's just been in such a struggle. And I know that, there's a petition he's got going on because he's having some problems with, they're trying to stop some of the things that he's doing as far as the positive things with child welfare. And so I just wish him all the luck.
Specifically, if I can speak to this, what's going on specifically is the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families, they have substantial contracts that goes into working with foster care, that goes into working with these children. And this is of all races and ethnicity, but because there is such a disproportionate number of chocolate babies, and specifically chocolate babies that get adopted into very vanilla rural and suburban areas, he said, why not give a big piece of these contracts to the agencies that look like these children and have a piece of them?
Right.
However, they keep giving them to two main people, and that's Children's Hospital and St. A's. And these are two great behemoth institutions. And on the surface, it looks like they're doing good. But when they came into the community, both St. A's and Children's Hospital, when they came to the community think tank that's held at St. Mark's Church, you know what happened? All the people ate into them about how they were not following up on promises, how they weren't doing this, they weren't doing. Now, they had a big special on CBS with Oprah Winfrey that covered it up, that made them look like they're doing certain things. And I'm not saying they're not doing anything good, because they got Tim and Ann Grove at St. A specifically that I really like. But I still think that even with them being good people, there's a big disconnect, and specifically with a lot of their staff. Even though they have some black staff, it's still a disconnect with how they interact with the community. But Children's Hospital, a place where I work, I know it's abysmal. I know that it's a lot to be that's lacking and wanting. And what he's saying is, why do we give these humongous contracts to institutions that have not shown to do all that they can for these children? But not only that, when they give these contracts, it's always some type of the best way to just say it is, when you have a person who's writing the contract that's on the board, there's always a level of conflict of interest that would raise eyes to somebody. And we scoffed at Trump when he put Ivanka and Jared within the White House, giving them clearances based on nepotism and things of that nature. But when we see the cronyism going on here, and we understand that it's based around dollars and keeping them in the different circles and feeding other people, well, then now we keep a blind eye to that. So if we're going to call it on one end, we have to call it all over. And that's one of the things that Brother Reed is trying to do. And you know he's effective because they're trying to silence him and shut him down. You don't silence anybody who's not doing anything.
Yeah. Well, look, I am going to make another announcement for our sponsors, EDOC, and at EDOC Advice, we provide specific medical answers to those seeking a better understanding by medical questions and health. And we offer our faculty of EDOC to our licensed physicians and health professionals to make themselves available to those globally seeking a better understanding of health issues and medical practice. Sponsors are also welcome. Do you have a service you want others to know about? Or if you have written a book we need to read, consider becoming a sponsor. Email the Black Reality Think Tank at thankopathink@outlook.com. Contributions to support our broadcasting efforts can be made to Cash App, Money Sign, capital NIRVANAINSTI, and PayPal, Sankofa Think Tank at Outlook.com. Okay, Brother Kwaku?
Yes, sir.
You can continue.
Yeah, and so
you
so
can continue.
About-
I know we was, you know, I feel bad for Jermaine. I talked to him actually last week, and he was telling me about some of the things that was going on. But this has been something that's back and forth. And he's such a warrior out there dealing with so many things, and so many people know about him. And I think one of when he was on WNOV, he did so much and brought so many people in to speak on some of the issues and things that were going on so many different levels. We had Dr. McManus on there several times, and she was a regular along with Dr. Du Bois on trauma in just in our past and stuff. So yeah, so I have a lot of respect for him and what he does. So I worked for him for quite a long time, and still actually do some work for him as far as training some of his people in de-escalation maneuvers. So, go ahead.
To the conversation, because we're talking about what sorts of things can we do to make some things happen. And I think that we sometimes do not realize our power. We have a tendency to complain and want something to happen. And I certainly encourage us to take a more active role in writing, for example, the school system. If it's something that we want, one of the ways of dealing with our concern is writing to the school board a certified letter that you're expecting a response back. And I have found that that has played a great role in getting people to get back to you. Mm-hmm. Have a way of getting to educate the teacher. And I've done this many times, going to my son's school and saying, I'd like to talk to the students about a particular topic. And I've done this on many occasions, which allows the teacher to have an indirect way of learning about some things they might not have otherwise learned. What I've not done, and I probably, as I'm listening to you, is that I could have done the same thing in a predominantly white school system and say, I'd like to talk to this particular class on this subject. And while they may not respond, they may not get back, I found in Milwaukee, actually, with that kind of a direct approach, that people do, in fact, get back to you, and you are able to teach other students as well as the teachers that are teaching those classes.
And I love that, because I think when we are proactive, that's when things happen. And what I would challenge all of us to do, and this is myself included, say, you know what, let's write that certified letter. Let's get involved in that manner. But also, you know what, let's not just be the person writing the letter. Let's be the person who receives that letter. So let's get on our school boards.
Let's get, you know, become superintendents and principals. Let's become the Secretary of Education. So then we are the person who's in charge, who's helping to change. Just as Brother Pugh said and talked about with Susan Rice, with her specifically in this position, hopefully there will be some things done. But she's kind of in the same spot with Kamala Harris. She has a white husband, too, and she was in that Obama era. So I wonder, is this going to be a time where she feels she can really let loose now, or will it still be kind of, hey, let's move slow? Because you're going to always have some people who say, hey, things are fine the way they are. Some people say, hey, progress takes time. You can't turn around a big ship, you know, right away. It takes time. Then you have some people who are ready for the revolution, who's ready for rebellion, who's ready for immediate change by any means necessary. And so when we start to look at that, we have to say, what do we feel comfortable with, what we're doing, with supporting, and then to move best in our manner. And when we talk about mental fitness, you know, these are the little things that we have to do. You know, and I can sum this up in three words: our diet, exercise, and sleep. Because, see, once we can control these things, then we can control those bigger things we need to do in life. But when we look at just what we eat, so let's just take this for example. When we look at what we put inside of our body, every time you put something in your mouth, you're making a choice, whether you're putting in wellness or whether you're putting in death. And this is a thing that even though we can articulate, it's not always easy to do. So every time we think about what we're eating, and when we eat, it can't just be about our foods. It's also about what are we eating intellectually? What are we eating mentally? What are you watching? What are you listening to? What are you hearing? So when we talk about how do we eat right, how do we get our diet right, and not a diet that's going to be for 5 days or for 10 days, but we're talking about a steady lifestyle and what we do. And it's the same with exercise. When we look at our body, when people look inside their body, one of the things on Abraham Maslow hierarchy needs, which I believe is probably in a position, he talks about at one of the highest level, we need a certain level of esteem. But when we look at ourselves, if we don't like what we see, or if we can't do the things that we need to do, then that's going to make us feel a little less. So even when we talk about when we exercise, guess what? That gives us more strength. That gives us more energy. So now when we're eating right and when we're exercising, those 30 minutes that we had to take in the bed because we're so tired, that could be the 30 minutes that we're writing. See, it's these little bitty differences that can start to make incremental changes inside of our life. And now this is the big thing, because when people start to talk about sleep, we know that the average person needs anywhere between 6 to 8 hours of sleep. Malcolm X famously slept off of 4 hours asleep, but I think he was a man on a mission who understood his time was coming, and he was really maximizing the time of what he did inside of the nation. But for the average person, needs 6 to 8 hours of sleep. Now, when you cannot sleep, that is a red flag of your body that something within your subconscious is not resting well. Because when you cannot sleep, when you cannot get into when we talk about that lower level of comatose, of unconsciousness, but a willing unconsciousness, that means something within our conscious level is not right. And most of the time that is because people suffer from a fakeness syndrome, and sometimes they don't even realize it's fake. We wear so many masks that sometimes we don't even really know who we are. And part of that comes from not having a sense of knowledge, a sense of self. And when you've been indoctrinated by the enemy, how can we ever expect our enemy to really educate us on the things that we want? We look at this vaccine. Whether this vaccine is safe or not is not the picture. It's the fact of all of the abuse from the years before that made us question it. And when you live in a society such as this, when you're wondering, is this right for me? Can I eat this? Can I do this? Can I say this? Will this really hurt me? Or is this really going to help me? That creates an unease. So when people wonder why they can't sleep, it's because of this equilibrium within their emotional state, because of the things that maybe they can't even articulate on a conscious level. So when we start saying, how are we going to be our best? It's about having a calm, having a knowledge, having a love about ourselves. And that helps to produce the sleep. Now, when we're up, then we have to have a level of discipline to make sure that we are exercising our brains in different types of manner. Make sure we're exercising our bodies from a cardio, from a weight standpoint. Brother Kwazi, I look at you, and I know you had a birth anniversary yesterday, just turned 60. And if anybody saw you, nobody would ever guess that you were anywhere near that age because of what the typical 60-year-old looks at. My father died at the age of 58, and so I never even got to see him live to 60. But even comparing your 60-year-old self to his 58-year-old self,
this conference has reached its maximum duration and will end in 1 minute.
And so what I'm going to say is, And to the point of mental fitness is, what do we have to do? It comes from a level of discipline. Even the diet that we have to think about, this is where America is not good. Because you look at what the FDA approves, you look at what the EPA allows to go into our hair, you look at what the CDC allows to go into our body, and even this is outside of the vaccine, the COVID-19, these are all things that we're eating that's legal. They allow cigarettes to be legal. When it was a fight for the soul during the Prohibition, this was right after the Spanish flu. So look at how all of these things are going to repeat themselves. We see marijuana becoming more legalized. Now, we look at how they allow different things that can be detrimental to our bodies to be legal. That's right. Why? Because it's a capitalistic society. And that's why I said, as much as I love Amanda Gorb, as much as I think she had a very beautiful critique, I do not disagree with any of those things. I do believe as a young person, there's always a level of naiveness, a level of...
One of the things I was going to kind of mention, when we talk about the mental fitness, and I talk about the trauma that we witness that they justify and okay, and I'm talking about with the George Floyd, with the kneel on the neck. Then they came out with a review from the coroners out of Minnesota indicating that he didn't die from, the knee being on his neck. He died from fentanyl. That was something that they fabricated. And then the justification of shooting Jacob Blake in the back several times and seeing that the officers acted properly. And, you know, and those kind of images, and that's seen from millions of people because that was played out over and over again. And the trauma that that puts in a kid's head, and those kids that were in the back seat of the car, I mean, that's something that those people are going to live with, and so many of us, for just such a long time, and the fact that they're saying that is okay, that kind of action is okay. Me being a former police officer and so many other police officers that I talked to that look like me, they know that they could not do that. And that certainly wouldn't have been justified if they would have did something, a black officer do something like that to a white male. As a matter of fact, you don't have black officers killing white people or white kids and walking away from that situation. I mean, we had one in Minnesota, and he got locked up right away. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I'll wait just until you acknowledge me. Go right ahead.
Oh no, go ahead.
As you were talking, I often wonder. Why haven't we ever been able to be taught how to fight with what we've been acclimated with? When you're in the master's house, I don't think the master will ever teach you how to destroy his house, so to speak. And so what is it that we need to do? For example, my undergraduate work was in chemistry, okay? But all it had ever been was repetitive, trying to ensure that I got the 80 or above to pass the course, et cetera, et cetera. But it never gave me an opportunity to learn how to fight with that. And so at what point in our academic or educational preparations do we get to learn how to fight with what we've been studying?
Okay.
Brother Quaco?
Yeah, I think that's why Brother Nate Parker wrote the film American Skin. And when you see that, you say enough is enough, and you say, how do we do that? Well, that goes into the elders teaching the youth, say, hey, you're not going to get this from school. I remember my freshman year going into college. There was a black provost,
And he said, hey, listen, they're going to give you an education. I wasn't smart enough to receive it. I wasn't mature enough to receive it. He said, you're going to have to learn this and then go to the library to learn more. And I'm like, I'm already studying for 12 hours, for 15 hours. I'm not studying nothing else. But what he was trying to tell me is you need to know how to flip this to use it against them. And so with that, you think about why did they outlaw so many of the martial arts? Why did they do so many things that they did to keep the brothers from the Vietnam era down? Because they understood that they came back with a level of skill that could do some damage. And when you look at how any great empire has been taken down from the thing, it's always been from within, from the army that was fed up and then overturned. And that's where the coups began. So what we have to do is what we have to do is the talk. See, we train our children to be compliant and to be complicit in their own oppression. Don't make them feel bad. Make sure you do this. Make sure you do this. Well, I don't have to talk with my children. I don't want my children to die. I don't want them to be George Floyd. I don't want them to be Ahmaud Arbery. I don't want them to be Breonna Taylor. I don't want them to be Trayvon Martin. I don't want them to be Tamir Rice. I don't want them to be Mike Brown. But you got to let's keep going on and on and on. I tell you what, you can quote me on this. I will be polite to the police. I will be respectful for the police. But as soon as the police stop acting like the police, they don't get treatment like the police. They will get treatment just like any other citizen. And that's what I tell my children. We don't go out looking for war, but we will not be victims. We will not be victimized. And then what we will do, if we have to be the catalyst, the one to start the revolution, then we will be the one to start the revolution. But we won't start it. We just going to finish it. And what we have to do is say, hey, it's not always about physicalness. It's so many ways to do the battle. You look what's going on with Wall Street now with GameStop. These people have learned how what to manipulate the market and to get these billionaires in all of a tizzy. And you see how Wall Street has rigged the game. But when people rig it back the other way, you see how they put it on stop down. That lets you know there's no fixing the system. So what you have to let the people know is, I'm not going to take this anymore. And this is what we're going to go to.
I'm sorry, Doc, you know, because as I was listening between the dialogue you were having between you and Brother Pugh, you see, Brother Pugh has the kind and type of logic, the kind and type of reasoning that doesn't come with us everyday lay people. And so how... Yes, there's a verbal judo. I agree that we all need to be able to learn, to be able to practice. But there are certain elements, and for example, we brought up about the police, as long as they have that badge and that gun on their chest and side, they have on us. And so how do we reason with other human beings knowing the kind and type of weaponry that they deal with?
Well, I think we had to go back to the school of Nat Turner and say, hey, listen, you know what? This was a person who dealt with everything inside of this system and said, this is the way people need to be dealt with. And like I said, a revolution can come violent with blood. It's what the quote I read earlier with Frederick Douglass said, it can come with blows or words or both. And so you can destroy a system economically. You can destroy a system in so many different ways in which you do. But if you look, and you look at our brothers in Haiti, you look at the 1804 freedom that they had, but how long it took to get it. What they said is say, you know what, enough is enough. Martin Luther King was all about peace, and so was Mandela. But then he said, you know what, I don't have to do the same tactics as Martin Luther King, because pragmatically, we are the advantage. We are the majority. So you know what he said?
Hey, brother.
Blowing things up.
Look, brother K. Cool, hold on a second. I want to just give some things. For joining us today.
I know time is up. It's been a pleasure.
No problem. I just want to thank you. Just let me put this in. I want to thank also the Sankofa Council for support of this program and for sharing the vision of the unity following the Afrocentric principles and helping us to learn to use those principles in our lives. Now, we look forward to bringing you more programs that we hope you enjoy. Visit our sponsor, www.eboxadvice.com. And we want to say good night. Stay safe, Sister Dee Dee, Sankofa family, and all of you. Until next time,
I just want to
thank you.
Usher.
Thank you, brother. Great too.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit. blood on the leaves and blood at the road. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here's a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here's a strange and bitter cry.
Hi, I'm Dr. Brian Parris, and I have an important